Let's have our brief safety review. Let's start with emergency situations. As far as exits, we have two main exits where the exit signs are posted, the two glass window doors. The main entrance to the room here is not the most recommended exit. That's why it doesn't have an exit sign on it, because you're actually going into the interior of the building, which in an emergency, like if the building was catch on fire, you might not want to run to the interior. But suppose you can't exit from these other two doors, you could go through this one, keep on going, and then there's another exit out of the building down the hallway there. So a reminder, the two doors on the left and right, here I'll do this airplane style, the two doors on the left and right are permanently locked. This one over here, that's the balance room, which unfortunately because of the drug trade, those are attractive balances, so we keep those locked up all the time. And then over here we have the instrument room, which you'd have to have a massive moving crew to actually steal anything of value in there, but still, we keep it locked up. We have, before I get to that, what would we do if we had an earthquake right now? Besides panic, not panic actually. Get underneath these benches, because as I've commented several times now, I bet you this roof could collapse and these benches would still survive. So get under the benches until the shaking stops. Why would you not want to go running out the room while the earthquake's going on? Because you've got glass in these doors, and why run the glass that could possibly break? Or, of course, there's always the issue of things maybe on the roof that could dislodge and fall. So wait for the shaking to stop, then escape the building. Most recommended of the two doors would be the one to your left here, because there's a staircase just around here. Although if that gets crowded because the other class that might be there, then we could go out the door here towards that staircase. But I usually recommend that one because in a panic, everybody's going to go for the big staircase that's over here. We have two fire alarms, one at each exit. We have the fire extinguisher that's on the right-hand side of the classroom. There's a telephone over there. No need to dial 9 to get to an outside extension. Just dial 911 directly if there's some kind of emergency that happens. We have the eyewash stations, the two real stations, one at the front of the classroom, one at the back. We have the safety showers, one at the front and one at the back. That's a reminder to comment about lab clothing, but I'll get to that momentarily. We also do have individual eyewash stations that are on the four corners of the benches here. If you need to use the eyewash station, 10 to 15 minutes minimum time is recommended. And just to show you this bit, the only reason that I've ever had to use this twice at the end is because not of a chemical splash, but because of lack of concentration. Because you're sitting there working, and you start to do this, which means you had your hands that were touching the chemicals that you're now rubbing into your eye, which means you can get chemicals in your eye, and that's why in the past a couple of people had to use the eyewash station. So just be aware about that kind of thing. I guess I'll comment on that clearly now, because I can't demonstrate the shower because of the huge mess it's going to make, because purposely there's no drain here. Because why would you want to wash off into the environment anything contaminated? If the point of this is to get you uncontaminated. So that makes me think that you might want to have an extra set of clothing just so you don't do like certain other people have accidentally done before and spilled so much of something nasty enough that you can't stay in those set of clothes, that you got to change into something else. Or don't end up like my lab mate back at Berkeley, who had to go running around in just a lab coat for a while because he didn't have an extra set of clothes and he couldn't stay in what he had because he spilled something nasty all over it. Since I'm on the topic of clothing, we are going to be getting into the warmer months, and so I know that more of you are going to want to wear shorts. I had one student that I think it would be 50 below outside and he'd still wear shorts. That was in the distant past. But, of course, we can't have shorts in lab, and whatever clothing rules we do have are just sort of logic-based. Or, for example, the issue about shoes. Some of you last quarter started out great about shoes, and then as you wanted to wear your fancy outfits or whatever, you'd wear the shoes that go along with it, which weren't appropriate for lab. We have this thing about closed-toed shoes. Why? Because your stick feet out and things fall down. If your feet stuck out backwards, we wouldn't care what kind of shoes you wore, right? So, well, the deal about closed-toe means no kind of opening whatsoever other than what the opening your foot would go in. And so Crocs, a lot of those don't work, sandals and such. because the story I told a couple of sections yesterday is about sodium hydroxide. You know, we treat sodium hydroxide as if it's nothing, because it's a chemical we're so used to. But if you get a little piece of solid sodium hydroxide stuck in one of the openings, like in a set of Crocs, you might not feel it, because, not to be too gross about it, but sodium hydroxide just feels slippery if you're having sweaty feet or something that maybe you feel the same way. Except that sodium hydroxide is going to sit there and react with your skin in a reaction called saponification, which is one of the first reactions we've done this quarter. But that means your skin's turning into soap, and so you're ending up with this super nasty chemical burn that you might not necessarily feel right away. And it's just sodium hydroxide. So that's why you need to have appropriate footwear so you don't accidentally get something stuck in you like that. For similar reasons, that's why we say whatever pants, skirts, jeans, slacks, sweatpants, whatever, have to go down to the ankles. So again, because things fall down, and so it's the lower part of your legs that's most likely to get splashed than the upper. Now, as far as up top, we don't have any specific recommendations other than the fact that the more that you cover up, the less that you're going to be exposed, the less that you have a chance of splashing something like silver nitrate or something on you. I do recommend lab coats. I'll be finally, I can't believe how many years I haven't had one, I'll be breaking down and getting one myself. And goggles, which you already know. But if you don't have a pair of goggles, we don't have the set that was put out one quarter for you to just borrow, because unfortunately they all just were starting to disappear. So if you don't have your own, you need to go get some again, which remember that you need to have side shields on your goggles. Now this kind I like. This is a UVEX brand, UVEX, which you can get from Amazon or Home Depot online. There's different places you can get these. Just make sure that if you do get something that's not from the bookstore, that it's rated as a chemical set of safety goggles. It's not just for yard work or something. Now back to the safety things in the room. If you have minor cuts and scrapes or whatever, we do have some first aid supplies in the stock room. If you are slightly more injured than that, or if you're feeling unwell, we do have health services over in the campus center that you might be sent to. And of course, if there's a real true emergency, then we'll dial 911. Which brings me to two totally optional things, which I think I've mentioned in past quarters. One is that if you do have any sort of pre-existing medical condition that you were comfortable sharing with me, that I might be able to help you if you had some kind of emergency. The example I always give is, back in grad school, a coworker of mine had an epileptic attack, and of course, there's no business of ours whether she disclosed that or not, that she was taking medication, but still, when you're in a research lab and someone's on the ground, you wonder not what's their health condition, but what chemical did they just use. So it caused a bit of panic that was unnecessary. Had we known, we might have been able to help or something. So me being responsible for you all, if you wanted to share that with me optionally, that'd be fine. One thing to consider, though, for women in the class, if you are or think you might become pregnant, this is probably not the class for you. I'm not a doctor, so I can't make that determination, but based on experience in the past, when I've provided lists of chemicals for people to take to the doctors, is it not? Because of the fact that we're using organic solvents and all organic chemicals, which are generally more immediately hazardous than the inorganics that you used in Chem 1. So if you wanted that list of chemicals, I could provide it. I would strongly encourage you to seek medical advice, though, if you find yourself in that situation. Food and drink. This is a 7:30 class, and I'm impressed. Did you hide the coffee well, or did you not bring it today? Drank it before class, okay. I've got to start cracking down on food and drink again, just because there are too many people that were starting to bring water bottles and such. So please leave it on the outside. Get it finished before you come here. I know it's 7:30. I know you need your caffeine, but I gulp my caffeine down before I walk in the room, too. So you can as well. Nothing goes down the drain, you already know that. Let's see, for your benefit, the chemicals that you're gonna need during the quarter are gonna be put out in the fume hood that's right over here, labeled H13. It says 12A and 12B, but those will be switched to say 12B and 12C. Waste is gonna be disposed of in fume hood H5 over there, the organic waste. We'll also have an acid and a base aqueous waste bottles that we'll put up at the front of the classroom here. Broken glassware, there's a broken glass container over here, the big brown trash can that's behind the soap station over there. And, I think that's all the major safety. Oh, I forgot to remind the other sections about this. We have the cart over here where we have common acids and bases that are used in multiple labs. Please note that almost all the bottles have some kind of color coding on them because they're segregated both by whether they're acids or base, but also which kind of acids are base. So there's a container for hydrochloric, there's a container for sulfuric, one for nitrate. Please make sure that you put the bases on the base shelf and the acids on the acid shelf. We do go through and check, but the more people that try to keep the system working, the better. Because at some point we are going to have inspections, and besides inspections, it's just bad safety practice to mix concentrated acids and bases like I have found sometimes in the past. Have I forgotten any major safety things? There's my two pet peeves that we need to discuss, which is part of the reason that you don't have a posted syllabus yet, because I'm seriously considering changing the way that I do grading for lab. Instead of doing grades based on lab reports, I'm trying to figure out how a mechanism by which I can grade based on observing your lab techniques instead, including how you maintain your lab environment, because the messes that I would see at the balance and the number of things left over here, given the types of chemicals you're going to be using this quarter, these will be the nastiest of the chemicals that you've used since you've been at DeAnza. So I'm a little bit more concerned about the laxness. Let me just get to my pet peeves. One of them being the simple act of closing the bottle. If I open this up and just lay this right here, if it happens like it did yesterday, the people in the front row in the mirror, they're going to go, why did you open that? And leave it open. Because they're sitting there and we're all going to be smelling it, which means actually everybody in the room is going to be breathing whatever this is, and that's the point. What is it? What are you being exposed to right now? And I think, well, put that darn cap back on. Well, that's exactly my response. If you've got bottles of things, yeah, you smell it yet? Yeah. If you've got bottles of things like acetyl chloride, that are reactive enough that they turn into a carboxylic acid after they decompose. And I could walk over there, I'm sure, during that lab and found the bottle left open at some point, which means everybody's breathing this stuff in, which means you're covering your lung linings with acyl groups, for one thing, and hydrochloric acid is being produced as an irritant, as a byproduct. So explain to me what part of that is acceptable behavior and explain what part of that is good for our health. All right, so why is it that that keeps on happening? Laziness. Some of you just don't belong in science classes is what that really means. If that sounds rude, well then prove to me otherwise. Prove that you can follow such a simple direction. Same thing with the balance area over here. Not that this is ever going to be lickably clean over here, but I can at least come over and see there's not much powder around here. Again, solids have a vapor pressure, so even if it's just a solid, that doesn't mean that we're not being exposed to it. And yet, in every lab, this ends up being a wreck. And there's this dance we go through where some people clean it up hoping that I won't notice in time, or by the time I notice, it'll be cleaned up again. But that means that whole time we're being exposed still? So really, is that good too? Is there any good reason for that? No, just laziness. Can't be bothered to clean it up. Which, if you're all going to be going to upper division and then get into internships, get into jobs, get out in the real world, you'll be fired for that. So why should I treat you any differently here just because you're students? You're adults, too. So that's why I'm thinking of changing. And I kept saying these things like, oh, when I go on sabbatical, you know, after that, that poor class. Well, why should I not care about you enough that I shouldn't bother thinking about some of these things before sabbatical? So that's why I've been thinking about a little bit over break. And once I finally settle down to decide exactly how I'm going to do it, well, then I'll post the syllabus. So just giving you some advance warning that those are my pet peeves, and may really do something about it this time. Questions about that? Because it's not any expectation that it's different than before. I just might get a little more serious about it this time. Now, the mechanism class. We've got lab lecture, which was the first hour, which is 7:30 to 8:20, which is when I'll go over normally safety or theory or aspects about the procedure that might be noteworthy. The one word of warning is that what happens historically is that I do require a pre-lab be done for experiments, and you don't actually have to do anything theory-related for that pre-lab. It's only about the procedure. But what historically happens is everybody worries about the procedure because they know I'm going to yell at them if they don't do it. But the theory, since I don't get on it, well, you know, there's bio class, there's that exam, and there's math, and there's physics, and there's this, and there's that. And so the studying of the theory gets pushed off and pushed off and pushed off until about 3 days before the lab exam comes up. And all of a sudden, everybody's really concerned about all the topics that are going to be on the lab exam. Which some quarters, it's okay because I talk about it enough, people can fake it even if they haven't studied it. But in Chem 1, people just get smacked. A students get Fs on the lab exam because they put off the study. So it's all just about discipline, not the difficulty. Lab exams are not difficult, but they're thorough. I think you'd all agree with that, right? So we will have two lab exams. They'll be based off the theory. So when we do discuss theory, do pay attention to that part of it. So the lab lecture will be when we talk about all that kind of stuff, and then, of course, you'll have the time for lab. The pre-lab assignment, there's two new components for everybody else that I'm adding in this quarter, which is actually somewhere mentioned, I think, in the syllabus. The syllabus has too much to say about pre-labs versus what we've been doing in real life. So we're doing a simplified version of it, but two items I'd like to throw back in. One, if there's any concrete safety warnings that are given to you in the text, I want you to put those as part of your pre-lab. Because we did have the incident a quarter or two ago where we had bromine and acetone, where the combination of the two made a lacrimer, meaning that if you breathe the stuff in, you can't breathe much because it's so irritating. And yet half the class had missed that note. You know, I did the whole pre-lab lecture, I got to the end and said, oh, by the way, how many of you saw the note about X, Y, and Z? And half the class had read it and half the class hadn't. So half the class was going to poison themselves with the stuff and half the class was going to sit by while that other half didn't. So I want you to put those safety warnings so that I know if you're really paying attention about it. Because I know the dance about that too. A half an hour for class, or maybe the day before because you'd otherwise have to be up that early. There's a mad scrambling of copying a pre-labs going on. Just make sure that when you're doing it, you get those safety notes as well so that you're not injuring yourselves. The other thing I want you to put in is wherever there's waste that you have to get rid of, put an A if it's acid waste, put an O if it's organic, and put a B if it's basic waste, so that we can do a little bit better job of making sure the different waste streams stay separate. Because I know what happens in the panic rush when I say, you gotta get out of the class, you gotta get out. The waste starts flying everywhere. But you gotta make sure that you're segregating waste properly. If you've taken the time ahead of time to know where it's gonna go, it won't take you any more time. You'll just be a little bit more careful about it. So wherever you get rid of waste, like if you do a wash, you're going to get rid of the aqueous layer, know whether that's acidic or basic. Or if you're getting rid of an ether layer, you know you need to go put it in the organic waste. So those are two new items. They aren't going to take that much more time, but they're two things that I've kind of ignored a bit too long. As far as the rest of the pre-lab, all you do is read through the procedure and do a step-by-step summary with only enough detail that you'd be able to do it if you didn't have the lab text to look at. So if it gives a whole big paragraph explanation about something you know you could write in one line, write the one line. And just list the steps that you have to do. There's always two, almost always two procedures, a mini scale and a micro scale. We will do the mini scale. We'll sometimes adjust quantities. So for the first lab that you're going to write up, leave a space for the possibility of adjusting those quantities. But the first write-up is only, even in the textbook, a couple of paragraphs long, so it's not going to take you that much time to prepare. Your first experiment is the aldol condensation. This is where you're getting your notes throughout and writing it down. Your first experiment is the aldol condensation, which means your first pre-lab that's due is on the aldol condensation. Pages 617 to 619. That's the theory part. 619 and 620, that's the actual lab procedure. There's just hardly a sentence or two on 619, and most of it's on 620. And again, we're doing the mini scale, not the micro scale. And again, leave space for the possibility of adjusting the quantities that we'll use. So what we'll do on Thursday, which I don't know if everybody heard the announcement, I will be gone Thursday, but I'm trying to make sure that at least lab will have a substitute. I will let you know by 9 o'clock Wednesday night whether or not we're going to have labs so that you know whether or not you have to wake up early in the morning or not. Part of the reason I'm not sure if we have a substitute is because we're down 3 instructors at the beginning of the quarter right now. So we're just trying to sub people that normally would be doing the subbing. So worst case scenario, there won't be class Thursday. We'll start lab on Tuesday. We will have lecture Friday no matter what. I'm only gone just on Thursday, just during the day. And I am going to do lab lecture today. We'll have a short break, but we're going to do a real lab lecture today to be ready one way or the other, either for Thursday so whoever substitutes can let you just work the whole time, or if there is no class, we can walk in Tuesday and just work the whole time. So pre-labs, one way or another, though, will be checked either by myself on Tuesday if we have to cancel class Thursday, or I will instruct the substitute to check your pre-labs carefully on Thursday. Questions? All right. So what I did for the other sections at this point was to review some of the final. We went over the synthesis problems and the fill-in-the-blank problems. Because of our unique situation, though, we're going to do the pre-lab. But what we'll do first is I already handed back all the papers, didn't I? So we'll take a 5-minute break to give those people who need a break an opportunity to run out, run back, and then we will start the pre-lab. Our first experiment of the quarter is going to be an aldol condensation. This is a reaction that's related to what's called the alpha position of a carbonyl. If we look at a carbonyl-containing compound, there is a common way to refer to positions of different carbons at different distances from that carbonyl. The immediate neighbor is referred to as the alpha position. Then the position next to it is the beta position. Gamma, delta, so on and so forth. Sometimes for convenience, the last position of a chain is referred to as the omega position because omega is the last letter of the Greek alphabet. So we're going to be concerned about that alpha position for today. Because imagine that I had something like the following. Let's say that I had some kind of base that was really strong, but it was really, really sterically hindered. The reason I put in that bit about being sterically hindered is I actually don't want the carbonyl to be attacked in this case. But it's still going to be really, really basic. So what do you think could happen between that really strong base and this aldehyde? Is the hydrogen attached to a carbonyl going to be all that basic? Would there be any kind of delocalization possible of a lone pair that would result from the hydrogen of a carbonyl being deprotonated? Not really. That's not a favorable carbon ion at all. Not particularly. Versus the alpha position. Because what would happen if the base were to successfully pull a hydrogen off the alpha position? Well, it got the carbonyl right next door that it could undergo delocalization with. In terms of molecular orbitals, this would be similar to an allyl case. If that was not a negatively charged product, if we did have a hydrogen on that oxygen, what kind of functional group would we call it? The question was, if the oxygen didn't have a negative charge, if it had a hydrogen instead, what functional group would we call this? An enol. Because it is an ion, though, we call it enolate. That's one thing to consider. What if we didn't have basic conditions, though? What if we had acidic conditions? Same starting compound. And let's say that we have a strong acid source, but no water. Strong acid, no water. What possible reaction might occur here? Really, the only thing possible is for the oxygen to react with the hydrogen, correct? Which actually means I need a reversible arrow. Now, that carbonyl we could show on paper as opening up. Really, this is just delocalization, but it's resonance. Well, we could have the counterion, the conjugate base of that acid that we used, come along and pull a hydrogen off. Which now we do make an actual enol. The difference between these two mechanisms is in the first case, the carbonyl is forced open by something happening next door, by a base coming in and attacking. In the second case, the carbonyl is made active by protonating it first. And this is that anionic-cationic dichotomy that we saw last quarter when we discussed carbonyl compounds. What is this process called? You've seen this before. Tautomerization. Specifically, when we go from a carbonyl, which usually this is shown with a ketone first, going from a carbonyl to the enol, it's called the keto-enol tautomerization. And you might say, well, yes, you have shown us this before. Why does that matter? Because enolates and enols react, and that you haven't been shown before. Let's go back and stick with just the basic conditions for a moment. I'll take that same aldehyde. I'll mention on the side that The circled proton has a pKa value of roughly 16. How does that compare to the pKa of an alcohol? What is roughly the range of pKa's for an alcohol? 16 to 18. This is 16, that's right in that same region, isn't it? That means in theory, if we used a strong concentrated solution of sodium hydroxide, we'd have a reasonable chance of deprotonating this compound. So, this is the first day that this section has met. So let me give you, right now, even though this is a lab lecture, let me give you the two warnings that I gave the other class. You see a pKa value written there. You'll see 10 or 12 others this quarter. You will need to memorize all pKa values that are quoted during lecture. Because many of these alpha chemistry reactions depend on knowing whether deprotonation is successful or not. Meaning you're going to have to compare the strength of an acid and a base. Knowing what's coming later in the quarter, amino acids, how many of you right now would be comfortable discussing the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation? Or what the significance of the half equivalence point is? Because both of those things will be testable items effectively later in the quarter, because we're going to be talking about the characterization of amino acids, and one way to do that is through titration. And the easiest way to explain pH values related to titration is the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation if we're using buffer solutions. And these are the exact same type of things that you would have to do in biochem after you all transfer. So for the one new student we have, this is related to some warnings that I gave in the past in 12A and 12B. And I did things like this at the beginning of the quarter where I said, here is this topic that's coming. Now, the warning's been given. You all may do with it what you want. Last quarter, the warning was about NMR, that we would be doing NMR problems. And we didn't do them for a while. But then, oh boy, did we start worrying about it. And then it was this mad panic about NMR problems, wasn't it? So you all don't want to be in a mad panic spring quarter trying to relearn acid-base chemistry as you all freaking out about apartments and wherever you're transferring to next. So you want to start now reviewing your acid-base chemistry. You've been given the warning, it's not going to change. So do what you want with it. The other warning, let's see, what was the other warning? It was another topic-based warning. Oh gosh, it'll come to me maybe by the time we get to lecture. A mini warning is that equilibrium's coming back, but not in a big nasty way. But if you don't remember your Le Chatelier's principle, you might want to read up on that. And I'll think on what that other warning was. But back to this, that all got touched off by looking at this pKa value. You need to start making a table of pKa values. Since I mentioned hydroxide, let me show you on the side that water has a pKa of 15.7. Which means these two compounds are about the same acidity as each other. So you would need to use an excess of sodium hydroxide to ensure deprotonation. Or I could show you a reagent that's often used to force deprotonation. But actually, since that's more of a lecture topic, and I want to make sure we get through the lab, I'll stick with sodium hydroxide for now. And let me write out in words what I just expressed. Since an aldehyde, on average, has the same acidity as water, or same acid strength as water, a concentrated solution of sodium hydroxide can often be used to form enolate ions. A preview of an issue that will come up is that since the acidities are so similar, though, technically any aeroarite will be a reversible aero because the compound could push back, try to reform itself, and generate hydroxide, therefore. But that's a subtlety we'll worry about once we get to lecture. For today, I'll just write everything as a forward aero. So I will rip the proton off of that alpha position. Many texts follow that up immediately with showing the delocalization of the negative charge on the carbonyl. That's not necessary. It's just showing that delocalization. So if you want to write a more compact mechanism, you could just stop right here, at least as far as the formation of the enolate. But if you have a negatively charged carbon, what's going to happen to another carbonyl? Isn't a Grignard reagent effectively a negatively charged carbon? It's more basic than this kind of compound. But if you had another molecule of the same aldehyde sitting next door, then couldn't that first compound attack and open up the carbonyl? And that's exactly what happens. An aldehyde, as we're going to see in a moment, can end up forming an alcohol. Therefore, the aldol condensation. Condensation because we're taking two of the same molecule and they end up stuck together. So let's see the rest of the mechanism. Again, painfully boring note about reversibility going to come eventually at this point, but for the moment we're doing this as forward. Notice that this is the formation of a new carbon-carbon bond. We might remember last quarter how important carbon-carbon bond formation is. So the fact that we have another way to form it means that this is going to show up a lot in synthesis problems. Yes? One, two, three. Oh, yes, I am. Four. Now, to help identify a condensation reaction, let me point out that the new carbon bond is formed on the alpha and beta positions relative to the carbonyl that formed the enolate. Notice also that one carbonyl survived, the one that was part of the enolate. The carbonyl that got attacked turns into an alcohol. And because of the type of attack that occurs, that alcohol always forms, always forms at the beta position. So I know this is a lot of detail to throw at you, but as you see more and more of these condensation reactions as the quarter commences, watch out for these kinds of tricks to identify the condensation that occurred. Because after I show you this condensation, there's five others that we learn. And you need to be able to identify one from the other. I'll give you a little bit of warning that in a few weeks from now, this will be the easiest of the three quarters, because we're going to be talking about sugars and amino acids and a lot of survey of chemistry. Not that there's not mechanism, not that there's not synthesis, but it's very directed, very one chunk of very well-defined, digestible content. These first few weeks are going to suck, because you have these six different condensation reactions, you have six or seven functional groups, each of which have six or seven reactions. So multiply all that out, and that means you're going to be awfully darn busy for just a few weeks. The way we'll survive it is that most of the mechanisms look like each other. And so the difficulty will just be knowing, recognizing the few specific cases I show you that are exceptional. And maybe we won't do all the potential reactions we could, because we'll never make it out of this chapter. But I'm just warning you that you're going to have to invest more time at the beginning of the quarter in this class. And then you can relax a little bit once we get past this hump. So again, when I give you warnings like recognize this condensation, you better believe that you're going to need to soon. Now, this is not done, because we have an anion, and you can't isolate an anion. We're also in basic solution still, so we can't use H plus at this point. We could imagine that if hydroxide initiated the deprotonation, that we have some water around, and so we could use water as the thing that quenches this alkoxide. But you know, if an alpha proton was deprotonatable once, why can't it happen a second time? Especially if we're using a hot, concentrated solution of sodium hydroxide. So I've again made an enolate ion. You might imagine another condensation could try to happen. But here's something quite unusual. Hydroxide leaves as a leaving group. I think I'll say that one again, because I don't say it very often. Hydroxide leaves as a leaving group. When is the last time you saw that? Oh, no, you did see it before. Borane. Way back when you learned the borane reaction, hydroxide is spit out as a leaving group. But the reason is because there's this thermodynamic push for bond migration that allows that hydroxide to be kicked off. When you kick off hydroxide here, what do you form? You form an alpha beta unsaturated carbonyl containing compound that's conjugated. When you form a conjugated system, remember that there's a stability that comes along with that you would not get if the double bonds were isolated from each other. That's why the formation of this compound is favorable. And that's why hydroxide can be a leaving group in this rare situation. This is the other potential product you could get from an aldol condensation. So under certain conditions, we might be able to isolate the alcohol, the true first product of an aldol condensation. But in this case, the conditions we will be using in this lab, where with heat and a concentrated solution of hydroxide, we'll push all the way to this alpha-beta unsaturated compound. And that is the aldol condensation. Yes? Why is it called what? Because look where the double bond is. The position near the carbonyl, that is the alpha position. And then one more position over, no matter which branch you take, that's the beta position. So it's called alpha-beta unsaturated. And that's a designation that's often used in biological compounds. For example, spider silk and a bunch of other natural materials that have long unsaturated carboxylic acids. You'll often refer to them by their Greek notations to differentiate them instead of naming out their big, long, nasty IUPAC names. So questions about this aldol condensation. Because this is a pure aldol, where you take one compound and you condense a second molecule of it. But what you're doing in your lab experiment is actually what's known as a mixed aldol condensation, which I'd like to show you now. Your two starting materials are para-anise aldehyde and acetophenone. Now, what's anisole? Didn't we just have that in the final recently? Oh, that's right. This is the section, that didn't go over the answer to the finals. What's anisole, though? That was something we had last quarter. An oxygen and a methyl group stuck on benzene, okay? Anise aldehyde is where you add an aldehyde to that. And it's in the para position, so that's why this is para anise aldehyde. Phenone is a common name for a benzene compound that has a carbonyl directly fused to it. Acetophenone is where you have two carbons, including the carbonyl, stuck onto the benzene ring. You have two carbonyl compounds. And not knowing any better, we might worry that were we to put a concentrated sodium hydroxide solution into this, we might get four products. The first one condensing with itself, the second one condensing with itself, the first condensing with the second condensing with the first. And as we'll see in lecture, there are situations where that can happen, where if you try to take two different carbonyl sources, you'll produce multiple products. But there's several gotchas about this case. This is a special case because which of these compounds actually has alpha hydrogens? Now, let me say this as gingerly as possible because you all are a smart group of people. You are a good class. I don't remember what the three sections class averages are, but maybe yours was higher last quarter. Don't know. But one thing that I recognize, and some of you have had me before know this, that even beyond the lab chemical pet peeves, there's one other pet peeve that gets me even madder even faster sometimes, especially if I'm not having a good day, which today's not one of those days. But you smiled. What is it? Not participating. Because it feels like I'm just lecturing to a TV screen, right? Which, why not I just sit in front of a camera and televise my lectures every day? You know? The reverse of that. Are you all that satisfied with my lecture? Do you all believe me that much, foolishly, that I do know what I'm talking about, that you have no questions about it? No desire to interact? Really? So when I ask a question, it's not that difficult. I mean, have any of you ever, even a story about me taking a student and just making one hell of a time out of them, give them hell for a wrong answer? Well, other than maybe Dante, but you know. So is it that bad to give me a wrong answer? No. The worst I'm going to do is look for someone else to give me the right answer. And I might not even say that you're wrong at first. If you notice, I tend to go from person to person, and then eventually the right answer just comes out. So, I'll try that again. How many of these compounds have alpha protons? Only one of them. Which one? So only one of them can start the process. Only one of these two compounds can make an enolate. So in a mixed aldol reaction, often you can get multiple products. But in this case, only one is going to make the enolate. So only one of the two compounds can form an enolate. Since only one compound has alpha protons. Acetophenone, I don't know its exact pKa. In general, a ketone has a pKa of roughly 19. Why is it higher than an aldehyde? Sounds like a good test question to me. Now, since you're new to the class, that was a not so subtle hint that one of the questions on the first test will be the difference in the acidity of these compounds, which is partly why you're memorizing the pKa values. But you're actually going to answer the question for me. So what's your answer?
Is it because the double bond is stabilized?
Okay, so the carbonyl definitely is going to stabilize the anion that forms. Why is there a different amount of stabilization in this compound, though, versus the aldehyde? Because both of them have the carbonyl, and so both of them have that stabilization. Ooh, now let's double check here, though. Which compound is more acidic, an aldehyde or a ketone? Is a larger or smaller pKa value more or less acidic? We have to answer both of those because I asked both of them as yes-nos. So larger pKa means less acidic, which means that proton is harder to pull off, which means there's less stabilization there somehow. Why? Because you already have the benzene ring stabilizing the carbonyl, lowering the delta positive that's there. This is why ketones are less reactive to begin with. That if you have alkyl groups that provide hyperconjugation, or benzene that provides conjugation, some way that gives electron density to the delta plus and the carbonyl is less reactive, also less able to handle a neighboring negative charge. If you destabilize the carbonyl, increase that positive charge there, then that makes it more likely for its neighboring carbon to want to get a negative charge because it could be tolerated. I'm not writing this down because we're going to go through, like I said, a set of 8 or 10 or 12 compounds and look at all their pKa values and discuss their inductive effects, hybridization effects, or resonance effects. The same three things that we had in 12A that affected the acidity of compounds. We have to review those items anyways because we're coming to carboxylic acids. And the acidity level of carboxylic acids is affected by what you have attached to it. So just previewing this story that we're going to hear about the acidity of different alpha protons. On a practical level, it's a good thing that this is the only compound that has alpha protons because hydroxide is going to have a tougher time deprotonating. This is a weaker acid than water, so you really do have to pound on this to deprotonate it with hydroxide. So continuing the statement I had previously, only one of the two compounds can form an enolate since only one compound has alpha protons. This is fortunate since hydroxide is not quite strong enough to easily deprotonate the ketone. Yes. Subtly, yes. So there can be a range. It's not that all ketones are 19. So depending on your side groups, it could slightly affect the pKa value. But most ketones are going to be in that 18 to 20 range. And we will talk more about structure effects when we hit this topic in lecture. Now, I've only given you one of the reasons why this condensation is favorable. And actually, I gave you the other reason in passing a moment ago. Once you make the enolate, which compound is more likely to be attacked? Recognize they both have benzene. Both carbonyls have benzene neighbors, so ignore the fact there's benzene there. Which one? The aldehyde? Is that what you're all saying? Well, what's more reactive, aldehydes or ketones? Aldehydes. Remember just a moment ago I said that if you provide electron density to the carbonyl, it stabilizes it, makes it less reactive. Having a hydrogen versus a methyl group, the methyl group stabilizes the carbonyl because you have hyperconjugation. The hydrogen can't because it's perpendicular to the carbonyl. So the aldehyde's more reactive, and so it's the one that gets preferentially attacked once the enolate is formed. So, because only one compound can form the enolate, because only one compound would preferentially react with the enolate, only one product forms. And let me write the complete mechanism for the formation of that product. So, the alpha position gets deprotonated. Optionally, you may show the delocalization of that enolate. Again, to save space, we just continue on with the reaction. It's going to attack the aldehyde. To preview the idea of why these reactions really are often written in reverse, look at the alkoxide that I just formed and imagine that it wanted to reform its carbonyl. That negative charge tries to attack the carbon. Normally we ignore something like that because we presume carbon-carbon bonds won't break. But what's the pKa roughly of the parent acid of this alkoxide? The other way I ask that question is, what's the pKa of an alcohol usually? 16 to 18. What is the pKa of this parent of the ketone itself? 19, right? If one's 18, one's 19, couldn't this potentially be a leaving group to the carbonyl reforming? And that's why the reaction can be reversible. That's why I put the note here that for now, we're ignoring that detail until we catch up in lecture. Now, this alkoxide that I just formed is going to do exactly what I showed you with the example molecule, where it will get reprotonated, and we can assume some water around. There'll be a second deprotonation. At the alpha position. And in a separate step, an internal elimination can occur. I want to emphasize that separate step element of it. Because for those of you who did really well on the final but made small mistakes, one of the common small mistakes was combining multiple reaction steps to save space on mechanism. But it's actually incorrect at points to combine steps. And this is one of those cases. The deprotonation is separate from the elimination, which we could prove using a kinetic study to find out whether it's first or second order, for example. If it were second order, the elimination, then that would mean the base and this compound would be required at the same time. If it's first order, well, you only need one molecule, which would be this one. So this is the mixed aldol condensation. That's what you're going to be doing on lab. Either Thursday, again, if we are able to get a sub, or Tuesday of next week. Now, in case I'm not here, if I could borrow someone's lab text, if anyone has it here. Does anybody have the lab text? Then let's pause momentarily while I go grab one, or do you have it? Can you flip to page 617? 617. Let's read your procedure. So it says prepare a 50% sodium hydroxide solution by dissolving 1 gram in 1 milliliter. Please, if I'm not here, be careful with the balances. The sodium hydroxide will corrode those balance trays. So make sure you don't put the sodium hydroxide directly on the balance. You may gently heat the mixture to hasten the solution, but be sure to cool the solution before proceeding. You're going to place the para-anisaldehyde and the acetophenone at the same time in, it says, a test tube. That's odd. You really just literally shake the solution. Wow. So you put milliliter of the anisaldehyde, milliliter of acetophenone, in 3 milliliters of 95% ethanol and gently shake. Says transfer 5 drops of the 50% sodium hydroxide solution, shake it, and allow it to stand. Wow, the products will just form right away. Cool the reaction in an ice water bath. If crystals don't form, scratch the liquid air interface to induce crystallization. Collect the products by vacuum filtration and recrystallize from methanol. Couldn't really be a simpler procedure. You'd probably finish it in one day. You'll do IR analysis, and anything past that, I'll decide after I get back. It looks like there's not going to be much to this other than once you have made the sodium hydroxide solution, realize that stuff is pretty nasty when it's concentrated, and it's going to be slippery as well. So if you feel slippery at any point, that means go neutralize whatever it is, or at least wash it to get rid of the base. Any questions? Now, it was at this time in the other sections we went ahead and paused. I could go over the answers that I went with over in the other sections of the final. If, because this is the first day, you would like a little bit of a mental break, though, we could certainly do that next lab. So what would you all prefer? Next lab. So we'll go ahead and break now. Lecture will start at 11:30. I will have office hours today, but they may be heavily interrupted just because of the disruption going on in classes.